Move to our last case.
Jimenez versus
the Department of Homeland Security. Okay, Mr. McClanahan.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Kel McClanahan. I'm here on behalf of all the plaintiffs. And I'll just say up front, at its core, this is a really straightforward case. This is about what words mean. This is about statutory and regulatory interpretation. There's a lot of moving parts here. There's a lot of small things, a lot of big things. But that's the thrust of this case, at least most of it. And because there are so many moving parts, I'm only going to hit sort of the big ones unless you have questions about the others that I don't cover. On this issue, the government advocates for what Judge Grant with Judge Hull called fair weather textualism a few months ago in June. Where they say that they apply the ordinary meaning of the text only when it suits them. That was the Greater Birmingham.
Are you talking about the exemption issue?
I'm talking about all the issues.
Well, no, pick one for me, please.
Well, we'll start with the exemption issue.
So we're talking about exemption three now, right?
Three, yes.
Okay. All right. So tell me why the Second Circuit has that wrong.
Because they ignored the plain text of the statute.
You can read their opinion and fairly say they ignored it. Maybe they're wrong in how they applied textualism and how they read the statute, but
fair.
I don't think you can say they ignored it.
And that is a fair criticism.
Tell me why they're wrong.
They prioritized the fair weather textualism. They paid very close attention to the words pertaining to. They hooked their entire argument and their entire holding on pertaining
Sometimes
to.
Sometimes statutes come down to one or two words.
That's right. But that's the Second Circuit. That is not generally the...
Wrong. Why is it wrong to say... In other words, I get your point. It says approval and an issuance. It doesn't say revocation and cancellation, right?
And it says issuance and denial.
It's just denial, not revocation and cancellation.
Right.
So your point is it has to say those two things or it only applies to those two things it says, which means that it doesn't apply to those things it doesn't say. But if it says pertaining to, then it pertains to everything... And it is a matter of pertinence and not exclusion, right?
Right. Well, I would say that you have to factor in the overall context. I mean, the entire supremacy...
Okay, so they looked at context. They looked at the title of the statute it was under, and the removal and cancellation part is under the title of issuance.
The issuance and removal, the 222F is under applications. Issuance is 221, or section 12.
Assuming Ergundo,
1201.
Let me read directly from the opinion. Thus, even assuming Ergundo that the language of 222F, which is the one you're talking about, was ambiguous, its application to revocations is certainly buttressed by the fact that Congress used the title issuance of visas to cover not just initial issuance of the visa, but also intertwine acts such as visa renewals, non-issuances, and revocations.
In 221.
Right. But if the point is Congress is treating it as pertinent issuances, revocations as issuances, then contextually it seems that the Second Circuit is reading it as a whole.
That's definitely an interpretation. It's an interpretation we disagree with, obviously.
I get it. I understand your argument, and it's not without force and persuasion. I mean, the Second Circuit took a long time to get to where it got to, but I just don't see how it's wrong to say that pertinence addresses more than just the two things that are stated there. It references those things that pertain to it. I think its receipt analogy is really apt. In other words, if you buy a receipt for something, that pertains to the purchase of it, right? So why is not the revocation, which is the flip side of issuance, not pertaining to the issuance of it?
I think a good way to look at it is that we're not trying to read out pertaining to. We're trying to say that pertaining to is not limitless. And so if you look at the definition of issuance and the definition of denial in 1952, I think, whenever the INA was written, those terms were not defined, but they were mentioned in 221. And they were mentioned, and 221I specifically said that in addition to all of the above, the person, the Secretary of State or the AG, I forget who it was exactly, can remove a visa and that this revocation shall take effect, yada, yada, yada. That was in addition to the other things about issuance and denials. He can remove it. That's a separate provision. And if they had wanted to, they could have put, and all records about issuance and denials pertaining to these things were in 221, but they did not. They put them in 222, in a separate section about applications, meaning it's about application information. It's about the acts that you do when you get the piece of paper saying, I want a visa. You either grant it or you deny it. Anything that happens after is after. It's something else. The expressio unius canon that the District of Connecticut used in El Bedrawi that was overturned by Spadaro went into this and said that Congress numerous times has set revocations apart from issuance and denials. And they know how to name things because they named them where they named them, and they didn't name them there.
All right, let's assume I disagree with that. What other fair weather textualism is in this case? I'm interested.
In the INA or on something?
Oh, this case. You've raised five issues.
It's applied to all of them.
Right.
So, I mean, we've got declarations here. We've got... Go ahead.
The second one is about the federal rules of evidence, about the admissibility of these declarations and whether or not they have to produce.
So I have a question about that. I agree with you that the best evidence rule applies in summary judgment. But where you have a factual stipulation of what the underlying requests were and what the nature of those requests were and the dates of those requests, then what more do you need? Why do you need them attached? Why would you not just need affidavits stating that a full search was done and here are the exemptions that apply at that point? Why do you need the best evidence rule where there's stipulations? And also, secondly, why isn't our rule with summary judgment that as long as evidence can be reduced at the time of trial, mm-hmm. both for authentication and for hearsay, as long as it can be reduced, then it does not need to be admitted at the summary judgment phase?
And those are two excellent points. And to the first one, I would say we're stipulated to the text of the complaint. We're stipulated to the text of the requests. We don't say they had to attach the requests. However, when they talk about the receipt, something that happened later, when they talk about, and in this letter we did this, and on this date we did this, that is not something we stipulated to. And it is something we could not stipulate to because we don't have all the correspondence.
But on the date they did something is an affiant. It's not a hearsay statement, and it's not something that is document-oriented. In other words—
It's also not a content of a writing.
Right.
It's not a content of a writing.
It is the content of the writing, though. I'll use the ICE example.
If I went on my computer and searched something on this date in order to look for something, that's not correspondence-related. That's not a writing, as Judge Hall eloquently said.
The example of the ICE responses, the four responses that they keep calling three responses. And that declaration goes to the content of the letters. When they say the first response was in December, the second response was in February, the third response was the next December, and they skip the June response.
Well, that may be true, but those other three are stipulated, and all of it is part of the stipulation of facts on when they responded to things and what the nature of the requests were. That's all stipulated fact.
But it's not stipulated that the December one was the third one.
Well, I get that, and there's some dispute as to that.
Right.
Whether that's a material dispute that affects anything is a separate matter. Yeah. But I guess I'm just failing to see how, under the best evidence rule, all this correspondence has to be attached where you have these two underlying principles. So get to the second one. Why can't this just be reduced to evidence at trial? Why do we need it now?
I made a note in my briefing of the advisory committee note to 56C2, where it said, yes, it has to be admissible, it has to be reduced, but that the burden is on the proponent to show that the material is admissible as presented or to explain the admissible form that is anticipated. And they just ignored the second half. They said, we're not going to try to explain how it's admissible because we think it's admissible because the best evidence rule doesn't apply.
No, but we know how it's going to be reduced. They're just going to admit the letters, their business records, and the records of the United States government. That's how they're going to be reduced. In other words, the same way that they could have done it, which is attached to their affidavit, they just admitted into evidence at trial. I'm just failing to see why that's – the best evidence rule applies, but at summary judgment, what we've said is you can fight by affidavit and you can include hearsay as long as it's hearsay and authenticated documents that can be admitted at the time of trial.
And you can include hearsay doesn't mean that you can violate all the other rules. And okay. that is our greater point.
I have a couple of questions.
Yes, ma'am.
Before we leave this issue, I looked in your briefs, and you've got to identify what statements in the declarations you're saying this correspondent was needed to be the best evidence of. And there was only one in your whole brief, in one declaration, one statement that you said, I need this correspondence for. And that was in the Holz's declaration that Machado submitted his record request on November 14th. I mean, right. You can't just say, I need all this correspondence for the declaration. You have to point to what in the declaration the correspondence is the best evidence of. And I saw no attempt to do that in your brief. So am I missing that? Maybe you don't have to do that.
Well, that is the argument.
Because you don't have any... But you're attacking the declaration, say they can't come in because they have statement. They don't have the correspondence, but you don't say what in the declarations can't come in specifically that the correspondence would prove. Do you follow my point?
I do.
And whether that's true or not as to whether that means there's no best evidence really issue here, I'm just trying to find out that's true. You didn't go in your brief and point out anything, right?
Right.
Okay, let me ask you another threshold question. If, as long as these are exempt under 3, we don't have to get to 5, right? We don't even need to deal with 5 if everything's exempt under 3. Is that correct?
No, the thing that it was exempt under 5 was not covered by 3.
What is the thing that was exempt under 5? Because I thought if everything is covered by 3, everything would be covered by 3.
That counts 7, 8, and 10?
Right. The exemptions were document and information specific, and the information that they withheld under B5 was not withheld under anything else.
Oh, you're saying that there was, in each request, some information was exempted based on B3 and some was under B5.
Correct.
But the line that's B3 was not also B5, and the line that was B5 was not also B3.
I know that the only line that we're challenging for B5 was not exempted by B3.
And so, in his first declaration, Stein explained material within the records withheld under exemption 3 was also exempt under 5, and in his second declaration confirmed that all the records withheld are visa-related records subject to exemption 3. Exemption 3.
Okay, then I stand corrected. So, you don't have to get to B5 if
okay.
You...
Okay, and I had one another thing that I thought was important. You didn't ever, during all of this, request copies of the correspondence. You could have filed a FOIA request for copies of the correspondence, correct?
I can file a FOIA request for any evidence in a trial.
Yeah, but you didn't. You never asked for... I mean, you're saying the declarations are defective because they don't have the correspondence, but you never asked for them to produce all the correspondence.
I didn't file a FOIA request for it, no, but I asked in... the court proceeding, and that I can file a FOIA request doesn't absolve them of...
I understand it goes to the admissibility of the declarations, but I'm just trying to make certain. Yeah. You didn't ever ask for those documents at any point. Okay.
Correct.
Okay. You've saved 5 minutes for rebuttal, Ms. McClanahan. Well, let's hear from Ms. Fraser.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court, Kelsey Frazier for the government. To begin, I just wanted to confirm what Chief Judge Pryor said, that this court does not need to reach Exemption 5 if it agrees with the government on Exemption 3, and that's from paragraph 7.
For the reasons that I stated from the Stein declarations, right?
That's correct. Paragraph 18 of the second Stein Declaration clearly states that everything withheld pursuant to Exemption 5 was also withheld pursuant to Exemption 3.
Well, that's State Department. He said 7, 8, and 10. 8 and 10 are State Department. 7 is Eggleston. So I don't know whether he's trying to say there's something in Count 7 from Mr. Eggleston that they were only relying on 5. That's 4 categories of records pertaining to Machado. So,
yeah, in 7, they didn't rely on 5. They only relied on 3, right?
That's correct.
Okay.
The only Exemption 5 withholding I understand to be challenged is from the State Department, the ones that are being discussed in the Stein Declaration.
Okay, and so Stein then covers it. Thank you.
That's correct. I did also want to follow up on the conversation you all were having with counsel on the other side about the alleged deficiency in the declarations for not attaching the correspondence. And I just wanted to make one higher level point, which is that, of course, we stand by our arguments in the brief that counsel has not provided any authority requiring the agencies to attach the correspondence. But even a victory for plaintiffs on this argument would not advance their arguments on the adequacy of the search, or the alleged inadequacy, as they put it, and the application of the exemption. So as I understand what they're seeking here, it's two things. From the Office of Biometric Identity Management, OBIM, they say that if they had the correspondence, that correspondence would show that OBIM did not start processing plaintiffs' FOIA requests until after this litigation had commenced, at which point OBIM may have had access to Plaintiff Machado's alien number. And that goes, as I understand it, to their argument that OBIM's search was inadequate because they did not run an alien number search in addition to a fingerprint.
I read their argument as being broader than that. Counsel, just, I mean, candidly, to me, what they're saying is, as a matter of law, you're required to attach these things. And if it's not attached, then these declarations are insufficient. And if declarations are insufficient for summary judgment, then you have presented zero evidence that there was A, an adequate search, and B, to justify the exemption. So that's as I understand their argument. Now, whether they're right or not is a separate point, but I think their argument is much broader than that, and that's how the district court seemed to treat it as well.
Sure, Your Honor. I merely mean to point out that the two examples that they've provided, even if they had the correspondence they seem to be asking for there.
Can we get to, I want to get to an argument we didn't talk with your opposing counsel, but that interests me, and that is what I'll call the misdirection issue. I think you know what I'm talking about. So,
sure.
As I understand it, a request was made to what I'll call the office, the biometric office.
Sure, yeah.
But okay. I call it the office because I'm simple. The request of the office asked for three things. One, all information on the quote-unquote ident system, which was provided. Two, what information was in the ADIS system, which was not, because that is under the purview of CBP.
Correct.
And then anything in any other system controlled by the office about the plaintiffs. And that apparently was provided or didn't exist, or was some stuff was withheld under exemptions. And so once we know that the CBP controls certain things, why does the regulation applicable here, and that is the 5.4C, not require direction to the appropriate agency once you know for a fact that another agency has the information they're requesting?
So, Your Honor, the regulation that plaintiffs are citing requires that the component of DHS that receives a request that is, quote, misdirected, route that request to the proper component who should have received it. It doesn't apply here because this request was not misdirected. The relevant question is whether the request as a whole was misdirected, i.e.
It say as a whole? And I will tell you this. I know in 2024, new language was added to the regulation, which seemed to clarify exactly the point that you're making now.
Right.
Isn't that pretty darn good evidence that that language needed to be added because at the time it could be read reasonably that a misdirection includes partial misdirections?
No, Your Honor, because the rule
that— Why bother clarifying?
Well, the rule that introduced that, I think, used the word clarify to—
It did.
—make clear that it was not changing the meaning, but simply further explaining what it had always meant. As a practical matter, these agencies are receiving thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of FOIA requests every year. And for them to go through each request, identify the relevant, the portions that they can respond to and the portions that they can't respond to, for those later portions, then identify the other component of the agency that might be able to respond, that's a significant use of resources.
And in instances where, I'm not saying that the current rule isn't really smart and good and what should be the rule, but you're governed by the rule that existed at the time.
Yeah.
And that simply said that this is what you would do. And I guess I understand that if we don't know where the component is or the component is a different agency or lots of other things. But where we know for a fact, I mean, the response is simply CBP has this. There was a rule that was put out that said we're no longer in charge of this database. It's going to CBP. Where you all know this and they're just down the hall. I don't understand why you don't put it in one of those old inner office things where you'd scratch out where it was before and put another one and send it down the street to the CBP folks as required by the rule.
Well, Your Honor, our position is that the rule does not require that because it talks about misdirected requests, and the request is the whole request, not each individual component of it. I'd also point out that OBIM actually told plaintiff at the time.
Yeah, yeah, it did in the response. She said, "You need this is not, we don't have the ADIS. You need to send your request to CPB." Actually, I thought your best argument was that you have a duty to respond to the request. So you've got this other statute that says you must respond to the request. And you can't just ignore that and say, okay, misdirected. So you put them together. You've got a duty to respond to the request. You responded. You said, here's what we have. This part's we don't have. You need to go. And so the misdirected, in light of the whole purpose of what you're supposed to do, means if it's to you, it's misdirected to you. You know, you're supposed to. But it wasn't misdirected to you.
Correct.
It was properly directed to OBM. And you produced a lot of stuff.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So that's how you'd have to argue it.
We absolutely agree, Your Honor.
And that's how you did argue in your brief. Plus, misdirected is really sent to the wrong address or destination. It's not looking at it in the whole apart. You know, they misdirect my mail. I mean, it's all the time. It just goes to the wrong place. If you look at the definition, you put a wrong address on it. If it's wholly sent to the wrong, I mean, that's kind of how you have to come about it.
Yes, we agree, Your Honor. And this request clearly was sent to the right office. It mentions and requests records from systems that OBIM does maintain. And in fact, as you noted, OBIM responded.
Yeah, y'all could have come and said, oh, it's misdirected because some of it's CPB. We send it on to them. We don't do anything. Well, nobody would have bought that.
Correct.
Okay.
What if we disagree with you? What if we disagree with the Second Circuit? Is there any way that you win on Exemption 3 if we disagree with the Second Circuit?
Well, Your Honor, I think the Second Circuit has the
best. I get it.
That's not my
question to you. I understand you think it's right, but assume for the moment that we disagree with the Second Circuit. Can you win on Exemption 3?
The other argument I think we would put forth beyond the plain text that the Second Circuit talked about and the statutory structure that you were mentioning earlier is sort of a practical one about how these things actually work. So a revocation, the way that decision works is an officer essentially reopens the adjudication file that resulted in the issuance of a visa. It's not a new proceeding.
I know, but the statute does seem to separate out issuance and the other thing mentioned and revocations and cancellations, right?
Well, we would respond, I think, with the statutory structure point, which is that the statute seems to use issuance as an umbrella term that includes revocations. And that's, again, because revocations are just a revisiting of the issuance decision. And so records related to the revocation also relate to, or pertain to, I should say, as the statute says, the issuance of the visa.
That really wouldn't be how an ordinary person would read that, though. I mean, an ordinary person, if you said, is something issued, they wouldn't think of, oh, that's at the cancellation point. That's just not how people would talk, right?
Perhaps, Your Honor, but the question isn't whether it is.
Would you talk that way?
Probably not, Your
right.
Honor.
I mean, so that's really how we're supposed to look at this stuff, unless there's technical or special meanings of some sort.
Yes, except for the words pertaining to, which I think make clear that the question is not whether it's equivalence, it's pertinence as one of the courts.
But there is an outer band there. I mean, it can't just be, there has to be some sort of nexus to the original issuance. And explain to me what the nexus is between cancellation and issuance.
So, Your Honor, I think the nexus there is quite clear. The cancellation is literally a reconsideration of the issuance itself. In terms of how we would sort of define the scope of what's pertaining to, we'd think of that as documents, and this is consistent with what the Second Circuit said in Spadaro, that were gathered or actually used in the adjudication of a visa application, whether that application resulted in the issuance, a later revocation, or the denial of a visa.
How's someone supposed to know that you're being honest about that? It's not like you say, we only looked at the original documents from issuance in order to make the decision here. In fact, all things considered, you're probably looking at some other stuff, like criminal records that weren't disclosed and other things, right?
I suppose two responses, Your Honor. So the first is, you know, we've submitted a declaration stating that these records are covered within the Exemption 3 because...
I know, but that's circular. I mean, your point is, we're looking at the same records, so that's how it pertains to, but how do we really know that unless you tell us what records you're looking at to make the cancellation or revocation decision?
A broader point, Your Honor. My first point that I was really trying to make is just that our declarations are entitled to the presumption of good faith. But the broader point is, I don't think it has to be the case that we looked only at the same records. We just have to have looked at records pertaining to the issuance. And because a revocation is a later revisiting of the issuance, if there are additional documents related to the revocation that change the consular officer's mind about the issuance, those would still be documents pertaining to the issuance of a visa and fall within Section 222F and thus within Exemption 3.
How do we assume good faith where appears to be clear inconsistencies from affidavit to affidavit? So, you know, in the one hand, or you have a response that has one set of documents and another that has another set of documents. You have one set of affidavits here where they rely on one exemption and then say, sorry, we got that wrong, and here's the other reason. We really meant to say this. I get that people make mistakes. I understand all of that. But when we're talking about presuming good faith, how is that not at least, for summary judgment purposes, some evidence to suggest that that overcomes the presumption at that point?
So I think there are two separate issues there. One is about, I think you're referring to the State Department declarations where they assert...
That's the second one.
The work products and then delivery
right.
process, yeah. So on that, I just want to be clear that plaintiff hasn't challenged those declarations as not entitled to the presumption of good faith. That challenge is limited to the declarations from ICE and from OBIM. On those declarations, the only alleged evidence that plaintiff has put forth is the fact that he received productions with inconsistent redactions. That's not evidence of bad faith. It's a result of the fact that multiple people looked at these documents, in one case several years apart, and reached different conclusions about what exemptions applied to what documents. Take the ICE productions, for example. When the agency realized that, it actually produced a final production that redacted the maximum amount of information possible. In other words, anything that was previously unredacted the maximum amount of information possible. Anything that was previously unredacted in any of ICE's prior productions to plaintiffs was unredacted in the file.
I know, but didn't that come post-litigation, or at least the sniff of litigation?
I understand that ICE...
No, I'm asking a question, yes, right?
Yes, okay. Conducted this because as part of a litigation review.
I know, and so that doesn't that indicate that only when we got our act together, when we knew we were about to be sued, that we decided, okay, that we're going to give you all the benefit of the doubt?
No, Your Honor, I think it indicates that ICE revisited its work and made sure that, you know, plaintiff had all the information to which he was entitled. Courts, including the Khachaturian court in DDC, have said that inconsistencies alone are not evidence of bad faith. We would expect there to be some inconsistent redactions when productions are being reviewed by different FOIA analysts, you know, at several years apart or months apart, whatever it may be. And so the inconsistencies alone are not enough to deny the ICE and OBIM declarations, the presumption
and
of good faith.
And that would be a problem if we said you're being more forthcoming. That's evidence of bad faith.
Correct. That would disincentivize
them to...
That's absolutely right, Your Honor.
So what if you get in litigation and you come up with more, you know, you just decide whether it's worth arguing about?
Correct, Your Honor. To the extent agencies might make errors in the redactions, we would want them to do.
Opponent, whether there was a Vaughn index claim. I didn't see any Vaughn index claim.
No, Your Honor,
okay.
I'm not aware of there
okay.
being one.
All right, thank you.
I'm happy to take any further questions, but if the court has none, we'll rest on our papers and ask the court to affirm.
Thank you, Ms. Fraser. Thank you, Ms. Fraser. Mr. McClanahan.
Thank you very much, and thank you, Judge Luck, for mentioning the reg, because I couldn't address that in a rebuttal unless you did. So I was listening to the earlier arguments.
Why is Judge Hull not right about how to read misdirection?
How would you read a letter that was sent to the person who used to own your house to your address? Would that be misdirected?
Well, it might be if it was only to the person who used to own my house, but if it was to, hey, Robert, how you doing? Let me know how things are with the family. And by the way, Jones, who used to own the house, can you ask about him too? That might not be misdirected to me. It might be partially misdirected to me, but it's not really misdirected because it asks about me too, right? That seems to be what we have here.
I think that the government is, not to put too fine a point on it, adding words to the reg that are not there. And it defeats the purpose of the reg. This interpretation, DHS, as I indicated in my briefing, DHS interpreted it my way until this case.
Well, that's not 100% true. They in March of this year, there was a clarifying amendment.
No, until this case.
Until this case, sorry.
Yeah.
There was a clarifying amendment in March of 2024, which clarified this exact issue.
How convenient that they said, and this is clarifying it, instead of we're changing it while they're in litigation.
That, that important, but I highly doubt that this case is what prompted them to completely change the regulations. I just suspect that that's the way it always was, and they just want to lay it out there so there's no confusion going forward, right?
The problem is that's not the way it was. In 2012, the memo that came out entitled Processing Misdirected FOIA Requests from the Chief FOIA Officer said that a misdirected request is one where the component that first receives a request may not have the records that are responsive to the request, may not have the records, might have some of them, might not have others.
You're reading a lot into that.
I am. Then in 2014.
That I don't think is there.
Then in 2014, they clarified that the misdirected means misdirected by the requester, which is an argument that they made before the district court in bad faith that it meant misdirected by Judge Luck sending the request to Judge Hull.
Right, but that would be the whole request. I think what we're talking about here is where there is it is sent to the right agency and is responsive for some significant part of it. How can we say that the entire thing is that a request, meaning a single request, is misdirected? That might stretch the meaning of it. In other words, going back to your faux textualism point, I'm not sure how that is faux textualism.
Because I gave an example in the briefing. That said, if I give a request for 100 different bullet points, and one of them is still with your office, and 99 are elsewhere, you can refuse to refer the 99.
That's a good point. But what we do have instead is 3 bullet points, and 2/3 of them were responsive to the correct agency.
Well, we don't know.
No, we do.
From the third point.
You have exemptions for it, but the point is there was one that was give me everything that you have in any database that you control, so we know that that's there. 2, there's the ident, which we know they control, and then 3 was the ADIS, which they don't. So 2/3 were, in fact, a request responsive to them, and at least part of it was not. And at least in that example or that case, it's hard to say that a request is misdirected in that circumstance. I'm just having trouble getting there.
When Congress asked the question, if your agency has a decentralized FOIA process, has your agency taken steps to make the routing of misdirected requests within your agency more efficient? If your agency is already handling the routing of misdirected requests in an efficient manner, please note that here and describe the process. The DHS Chief FOIA Officer said, in 2012, the DHS FOIA Privacy Office issued a memorandum on processing misdirected requests, emphasizing the importance of routing misdirected requests to the appropriate component as soon as possible. DHS and its components handle misdirected requests during daily triage and route the request within one business day of receipt, if possible, via email. They did not tell Congress if there's nothing in there that the component has. They were touting this policy as we're doing what Congress wanted and making sure that requesters get their information. I only have a little bit more minute.
You have 10 seconds.
The bad faith, we're not saying, if I can just have like 30
seconds. No, you got, I mean, you had extra minutes in your opening, okay. Mr. McClanahan, we got your brief. I think we understand your case.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We're in recess until tomorrow.